I'll just start that now. And looks like we're all good to go. So this is Edith Bellinghausen. I'm here at the Crest Foundation on East 80th Street in Manhattan with Terry Slater. I have some questions written out, so if I'm sort of looking down or making notes, then
okay.
It's just to steer things. All right, so I just want to start with if you could tell me briefly about your background and if you're from New York originally.
Well, yes, I am from the New York region. I'm a native New Yorker and a native Upper East Sider, except for a few years in Palo Alto, California. I've lived in actually this very neighborhood, in different areas of this neighborhood, all of my life. Some of it was in, I'm in actually Yorkville now, but I was a little outside of Yorkville before, and then farther west for many, many years. But this is my beat.
So this is your home.
Yes.
And so you really know the neighborhood.
I do. I feel that I do. I've seen the changes that have taken place over the years. My background was not in preservation. I worked for a large corporation for a number of years, and then I taught for a couple of years when I was in California. But I was always a preservationist at heart before I left for California, came back. But actively, when I came back to New York, one of the very first things the campaign I joined was to create the Upper East Side Historic District. And that was a huge campaign. The scope of what people were trying to do, particularly the many fine buildings, which many of them could be individual landmarks, but the area held together as a place, and that's one of the requirements for it, had a sense of place for historic districts. And
What year was this?
This was the early 80s. I lose the years, 81, 82, I can't remember, but people were working on it for years before that. Many people, Friends of the Upper East Side Historic Districts, led the charge. Helena Rosenthal, who was my mentor, she was like a sister to me, a remarkable, remarkable woman. We'll never see the likes of her again, but...
I'm definitely going to want to come back to talking about Helena for a little bit.
Yes. But she led the charge, and it was quite a battle because the Real Estate Board of New York was horrified at what we were trying to do. They don't like regulations, you may know that, mm-hmm. And concessions had to be made, you know, where the boundaries were, what was left out, and that became problematic for a lot of us, but you have to... I guess politics is the art of compromise, and we had to cut back. The Madison Avenue guidelines for the commercial area along Madison Avenue was a component of this whole effort in that they wanted to be sure that the historic district regulations didn't hamper the flow of commerce on Madison. So the guidelines that they have for signage on Madison Avenue are not like the guidelines anywhere else in the city. They're much more liberal, mm-hmm. shall we say. So that was another concession that had to be made, where the boundaries of that district were too, was pulled in.
So what was happening in the neighborhood, I guess, at that time that you think was the impetus for this movement?
Well, there were two things. The fact that we were losing buildings, I mean, people noticed this when you look at the grid, the city's grid, particularly in Manhattan, you see that the taller buildings are on the avenues and the lower buildings are on the side streets, okay. And this is true here. We have many row house blocks. It's not like our sister community board, the Upper West Side, where you have rows of really pristine row houses. A lot of these small buildings had already been altered in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and they were, for want of a better word, fancified. You know, they were made into more elaborate buildings from humble row houses, brownstones. They were made much more elaborate with limestone facades and so on. But the height remained, the brownstone height, the row house height on the side streets. But the zoning was not in sync with that look. The zoning permitted buildings, it was R8, not R8B, which is contextual zoning now. So the R8 zoning permitted, I believe, buildings up to maybe, I hate to say this, 14 stories. I'm trying to remember.
Even what in mid-block.
In mid-block. Mm-hmm. And it had been done in places. And buildings were being altered in inappropriate ways. We were losing, you know, the real feel and look of the historic areas, the historic mid-block. So that's what people began to notice. And other buildings had been torn down, magnificent buildings to build apartment houses. And, of course, it just went right out of my head. I meant to bring my notes, but I left them at home. 79th and Park, there was a magnificent building. And that was torn down to build... you'll see there's a Botero sculpture, a different Botero sculpture in front of that building. That was a magnificent house that was torn down. There were things happening. And people, many people realized the value, you know, of this historic area. And this was this big communal effort, all of the different people, existing groups and individuals, working hard to change that and stop it.
So set the scene for me. Who was active at the time, and who were sort of the preservation groups that were active on the Upper East Side at that time when you became involved?
Okay. Well, Friends of the Upper East Side Historic District spearheaded this whole movement. They really could... Helena was in the forefront. She was a visionary in many ways. And she was not a preservationist by training. She was by nature a preservationist and a remarkable person, as I said. And so Friends spearheaded it, but the other existing groups were Carnegie Hill Neighbors. My co-chair, Elizabeth Ashby, was, I don't know if she was yet president, but she became president and was president for many years. Civitas was another group that got involved. There are many block associations. You'd be amazed at the number of block associations and how old some of them are. The Treadwell Farm area has a block association that is very old. I think it goes back to the 20s. There was a block association on my block where I lived for so many years that was founded during 78th Street between Lex and Park. It's the East 78th Street Block Association, okay. Park Lex, one block. I thought we did a lot of good. Certainly while I was there, but they were on board, and they were founded during the Lindsay administration. You know, I mean, some of these, and there are others all over the Upper East Side. You know, they're mostly invested in cleanliness, planting trees and flowers, and, you know, safety issues and so on, what you would think a block association. But this appealed to so many people because they really appreciated the look and feel of our neighborhood.
Right, that sense of place that you referred to earlier, that sense of place.
Yes, the sense of place, very important. And also, when the Landmarks Commission looks at areas, that sense of place, you know, it holds together as a district. You can't have two buildings here and then something strange and then one building over there. You know, this really flowed. It flowed. Right. And happily, at the same time, the feeling that the zoning, and Helena was in the forefront of this as well, had to change to be in sync, that there should be a happy marriage between the district regulations, landmarks regulations, and the zoning regulations. And this is not true in all of the different parts of the city where there are historic districts. You have the pressure of the zoning being different from what they're trying to preserve, and people are trying to bring those two components together.
It seems that they tend to... exists very separate zoning and landmarks regulations.
They are.
Even today, there's not a lot of communication there, I don't think.
Indeed. When there was a battle, I'm not going to go chronologically, but there was a battle to preserve a block up on Madison Avenue in the 90s. It was called the Citibank fight.
Right.
And there was a Citibank building, a low one-story, you know, Federal, whatever it was, building, which the Landmarks Commission had the foresight to include in the historic district. So an apartment building was proposed for that site. Developers bought it. And the zoning permitted 19 stories. Maybe Elizabeth talked about this, 19 stories or 210 feet, whichever is less. It was the last low-scale brownstone block on Madison Avenue. And that's what people were trying to preserve. It would have been so wonderful if they had been able to keep that. But ultimately, I think the building that is there now is 11 stories. They were trying to build, I think, 17 or 18, something like that. And it's not as bad as 17 or 18, but the goal was to preserve the low-scale brownstone character, you know, the low-scale character, because it's such a precious area that's part of Carnegie Hill.
Yeah, I want to get back to that specific issue with 91st Street in a moment. Mm-hmm. Let's circle back and talk about Friends.
Sure.
And your relationship with Helena and how she was acting.
Well, it's kind of amusing because when we first moved to 78th Street, my husband noticed a crack in our parapet. We had a brownstone. And he said, oh my goodness, that's where I think there's some water getting in, because he noticed a damp spot in the ceiling below the roof. And we'll have to address it. So we called someone, and we weren't, you know, trained yet as far as, you know, anything you do, you have to get a certificate of no effect, or you have to get a certificate of appropriateness from the Landmarks Commission. We had just come back. And so we got a contractor, hired a contractor, had a scaffold, phone rings, and this very exotic sounding voice said, hello. And I said, yes. And she said, is this Mrs. Slater? And I said, yes. And she said, you are in violation of the historic district or something like that. And I said, what? And she said, you have a scaffold and this is an historic, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that P.S. I was drawn into her aura and ultimately joined Friends and was a vice president for many years. And I enjoyed my time there so much. And Helena was just, I'm telling you, she was like a sister. She was my mentor. I learned so much from her. And, Tony can tell you, we were devastated when she passed away. She had cancer and died. She was in her late 70s, I think, by then. But she should have lived to be on same happy birthday on Good Morning and whatever it is, Today's Show, you know, because she was the kind of person who should have been around until she was over 100. Because we learned from her so much. It was her manner, you know, the way she treated people and her savvy. I mean, she was highly intelligent and so on the mark on so many different issues.
Yeah, I understand she had a very distinct way of dealing with people in a very friendly yet firm manner.
Oh, God, and some of the, I hate to say scuzzy, but some of, I shouldn't say this, scuzziest land use attorneys in the city, you know, who would, you know, cringe when they heard the name Helena Rosenthal. And she'd just walk right up to them and offer them. She always had a bag of candy,
yeah,
hard candy. And she'd walk up and give people, I don't want to say the names on the tape, but, you know, the most successful, I mean, these men are just incredible. Legends in their own minds, actually. But anyway, she would offer them hard candy, and they'd look at her, and actually, they take the hard candy, you know, and they had great respect for her because she was so effective. I mean, she was so effective in everything that she did, and this worked for her. It wouldn't work for me. I mean, they'd laugh if I carried around a bag of candy, you know, just, you know, yell and scream back and forth. But she was remarkable. I mean, just amazing person.
That sounds like a special relationship and a way that got you probably even more involved, would you say? Because of the...
Absolutely. I mean, she was like a magnet for me to Friends. I'm not a joiner, per se. I tend not to join organizations. I just have a thing about it. But with Friends, it was different. It was all Helena. And for me, Friends was Helena and still is in a lot of ways in my mind.
How did you think the... or maybe you can describe for me... sort of how the different groups interacted. So you had Friends, you mentioned Carnegie Hill Neighbors, Civitas, the Black Associations. What was, you know, how was the interaction?
Generally speaking, in preservation, just not in the Upper East Side, but all over, people try to be cooperative, you know, and when you're in the middle of some sort of advocacy battle, you try to get support from many different organizations. You have your list of supporting groups. And at the same time, with certain kinds of groups, there's a competition, a competitive edge, because they're all vying for the same members if they're membership organizations. So while you may support somebody's advocacy efforts on one level, you want to take credit too for being in support of that advocacy effort. And this is always sort of under the surface. And it's too bad because the money is necessary to do any of this or substantial. I mean, if you want to have an advocacy campaign, like Friends' most recent advocacy campaign to landmark, to create a little historic district, to extend the Upper East Side Historic District along Lexington and some of the side streets, requires a lot of money to print material, to get people out of there. You're using your staff to do the kind of advocacy you hope will achieve your goal. If you go into any kind of litigation to, if you take something to the Court of Appeals, you're talking about $300,000. I've been involved in those battles. You have to raise that money from people. So these groups, all wonderful groups in their own right, Civitas, Carnegie Hill Neighbors, Friends of the Upper East Side, all have been, each one has been involved in this kind of campaign. Block associations tend not to do that kind of thing. They join on in support. But it's these groups, especially in the Upper East Side. On the West Side, it's Landmark West. And I think, I don't know if there are others, I don't think there's anybody like Landmark West, any other group like Landmark West on the West Side. But, you know, it's expensive, it's time-consuming, and it's hard work. But there is that competitive thing going on between groups. It happens with environmental groups, too.
But competitive over a pool of funds?
Well, I think in the pool of funds, potential members, and getting credit for this fight, you know, whatever the fight may be. It's always like that.
I want to talk about formation of your organization, Defenders of the Historic Upper East Side.
Sure.
What would you say are the key events that led up to that? And what made you want to form that group after, you know, seeing the activity that was going on, your involvement with Friends? What was the impetus, I guess, for Defenders?
It was, I guess, observation on my part and Elizabeth Ashby's part. And it coincided with, there was a big preservation battle going on at Friends. We were trying to save the Central Park Children's Zoo. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it was where the whale was and the ark. And it was just this charming, I guess maybe it was an anachronism. When I look back, I think maybe we shouldn't have bothered with this at all. I don't know. We felt it was a really important, iconic spot in New York where a lot of people, it was kind of a landmark of the heart. Everyone had a reminiscence, some kind of memory of being in this place as a child, you know.
I went there as a child as well.
Exactly.
From New York, and I definitely remember the zoo. And it has a special nostalgia,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah. Well, it was a huge battle. It turned into a huge battle. And Helena was, she resisted litigious behavior. She didn't like to take it to court, but she wasn't against other people doing that. She supported the battle. If it required that in the end, that's what had to be done. And Elizabeth and I realized that so much of the time now, the pressure of the real estate pressure in the city, which is the engine that drives the city, make no mistake about it, very often collides with preservation efforts. And when a neighborhood wants to save something precious and historic, frequently they're almost required to hire an attorney. And that's only part of the picture. They're working with community group, which is what we do. We consult, we advise, we have, you know, all of the different architectural historians, lawyers, the whole bag of tools you need to fight a battle like that. We're different from Friends in that we don't testify in each and every issue in the Upper East Side at the Landmarks Commission. We do frequently testify, but we don't testify every single month. But we do regularly work with community groups, and there have been several in the recent past. Whitney Neighbors, the Whitney Museum, and the Whitney Brownstones. Developer was trying to build over the Park Burnett building on Madison Avenue. They're just two recent ones. But, you know, they're big battles, and they're still in going on, believe it or not. There's now a developer with another scheme for the Brownstones next to the Whitney. And the efforts by the other developer building over the Park Burnett are unresolved at the moment. He's asking for a zoning text change to enable him to build the kind of smaller building he wants to build now. He proposed a 37-story building. Lord Foster was the architect.
Right, and that's Abbey Rosen's development.
Yes, the green building. Yeah,
right,
yes,
right. Exactly. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that in particular, because I've seen his name come up a few times in the research that I did for this. So that's 980 Madison, Park Burnett. So what you said that it was not resolved then?
No, the Park Burnett building actually, it was, I don't want to use the word covenant, but there was an agreement between the Carlisle Hotel and the, I think they may have been the same owner. I'm trying to remember the history at one time. That was supposed to remain, that it was never designed like the building downtown. I'm terrible with names.
You mean designs of
Condé Nast building. Right. The Condé Nast building was designed with the thought that there would be a building built above it, on top of
right,
it,
like the
as
Hearst
a base.
Building also.
Right. That was not true of 980 Madison.
Right.
It was meant to be low to preserve the views of the Carlisle Hotel.
Right.
So there have been many people thinking about that building over the years. But in the context of Madison Avenue, it's one of the most important buildings along Madison Avenue in that it has, it's of a time. It had a relationship with another building. It fits into the Upper East Side Historic District beautifully if you walk up and down Madison. And that proposal for Norman Foster's, this huge building, I mean, he's a fabulous architect. He designs buildings all over the world, the Tate Gallery and so on. It's just that it was wrong for that place. It might have been wonderful in some other part of the city. And people just went berserk when they saw it. I mean, you know, it was just so shocking to see something so wildly different from everything around it in terms of materials, height, bulk. I mean, it was just wrong. So the neighborhood rose up, a group was formed, and the battle began. And we got involved with that group. And we're happy to say that that plan was abandoned. But there's and this is frequently what happens when an architect proposes one scheme, and then that scheme is rejected either by the Landmarks Commission or someone else, and then they come back with a second idea. The second idea is never quite as important as the first idea architecturally. It's
right.
Sad. It's just the way it is. And this time, my humble opinion, it looks like a parking garage. I mean, yes, it's low scale. It's a very strange design, and it's squat, and it uses, it's just a doubling of the bulk. It has no relationship to the Park Burnett building, and it just sits on top of it. And I believe it was approved, and the neighbors were still very unhappy about it, because there are rules at the Landmarks Commission for rooftop additions, and this was being called a rooftop addition. And normally rooftop additions are one story and set back.
Right.
And the rules were kind of not quite adhered to in this case. So they're still working on it. And in order to build a building on Madison Avenue, setbacks take place at a certain height. And that's what he's applying for now, so that he does, he wants a waiver. So it's unresolved. We haven't heard from city planning. We don't know what, well, they touch base regularly, the group, and, you know, touch base with us. And we're ready to go at it again, you know.
So are you, does your organization essentially play the role of consultant or of sorts, or of almost a service provider to the
kind of you, that's one way to describe us. Yeah, we are sort of, we act, I mean, if you look at our brochure, we say we act in partnership with community
right.
groups. We
as
guide them, you know, through the process, because most people basically aren't involved in zoning issues, landmarks issues. They just have very pleasant lives, you know, without getting involved in neighborhood, you know, battles of one kind or another. And they don't know which direction to go in when something like that happens, what kinds of attorneys you might, may or may not need. You know, ending up in court is not something anybody wants to do. We
right.
certainly don't. And we don't suggest that as a, but sometimes just having legal representation when you're up against a big developer with, you know, the top law firms and Higgins and Quaysbarth, you know, advisors like that. I mean, it's overwhelming.
Right, so you're a real resource.
Yes. I think we're a realistic resource. We look at what's happening in the city, and we try to advise the people we work with to be forewarned is forearmed, and hopefully you will never have to go to court. But they know what to do, you know, after we sit down and talk with them.
You mentioned earlier the building at East 91st Street.
Yep.
It's in the Carnegie Hill Historic District. And what happened? I read that there was a lawsuit that was brought to the LPC for that.
No, I'm trying to remember if there was.
City Neighbors Coalition? If that rings
Say
a bell.
That again.
Organization called City Neighbors Coalition?
Yes, Woody Allen was involved, and he certainly came down to the Landmarks Commission, and I'm trying to remember. I know... I don't know if it wound up in court. I'm having a memory thing about it. They certainly had top land use attorneys working for them, the developers, but I don't know if it actually ended up in court. I'm trying to remember.
So, but either way, it sounds, I mean, you mentioned earlier that they did
no,
actually...
No, it did end up in court. Okay. Sorry. It just came back to me because it's like a flood of memories I'm trying to deal with now. It did, and it got to the Court of Appeals, and it wasn't decided on the merits because the building had already been built. But there was an issue about the Landmarks Commission having to do or not having to do an EIS. In the old days, they would have to do an EIS. And when Jennifer Rabb was the chair of Landmarks Commission, she felt that requiring the Landmarks Commission, because of staffing issues and other kinds of time issues, that they should be waived from having to do that. They shouldn't have to do it at the Landmarks Commission. And the rule is any agency that makes discretionary decisions, like the City Planning Commission or other agencies, can be would have to do an EIS in a case like this. And I think she was able to change some of the rules in Albany that related to this. And that issue remains unresolved, and, you know, the court didn't rule one way or another on that. It was just kind of unresolved, and it was kind of moot because the building had been built. But that issue may come back someday, you know, whether the Landmarks Commission has to do an EIS in cases like this. So I think that was part of a very interesting outcome of that particular battle.
Tell me about the cottages on Third Avenue.
Sorry, I didn't bring photographs with me.
I would have loved to have seen it because it's impossible to find anything online that documents what it was.
It's just another New York story. You know, it was one of these hidden places, and what did it in, I guess, was the fact that it wasn't open to the public. It was a wonderful two-story building on... Third Avenue between 78th and 77th Street on the west side of Third. And behind the building were apartments. The second floor were all these wonderful apartments, one-bedroom apartments with fireplaces. The ground floor level were stores. It was a mixed use. In back of it was this wonderful garden. There was this glorious terrace. The grand stair that led to the terrace, which where the entrances to these apartments were. There was a building on 77th Street, a wonderful building, very deco-y kind of building that overlooked the gardens. There was a gate on 78th Street, and you could stop. You'd hear the birds, actually, before you got to the gate. I mean, it was just this wonderful bird sanctuary. And you'd look in and see this lovely garden. Was not open to the public, sadly. Could have been like a vest pocket park or something, while ensuring the security of the people who lived in the little apartments. Right. Has a great history. Brendan Gill lived there at one time. He had an apartment there. Originally, I think there was a tennis court many years ago, maybe in the 30s or something, but it evolved into this garden. And it was just one of those magical places everybody knew about in the neighborhood, but you really couldn't communicate this to people without bringing them there, you know? And so we this effort began to save it because, again, there was the threat of development. A.B. Rosen was the developer. One thing led to another, and the Landmarks Commission just would not look at this. And other groups, like Landmarks Conservancy, didn't think it rose to the level of, you know, landmarking it on its own merits. That block could have been landmark because this is one of the things when we go back to the Upper East Side Historic District. Ideally, that block of 78th Street between Lex and 3rd would have been included in the Upper East Side Historic District. It was not. So what Helena did, and she did this on her block and on this block, there are little individual landmarks that are remarkable carriage houses on 73rd Street between Lex and 3rd on her former block, and on this block, remarkable little row houses. So they all became individual landmarks. And had that block been included, the cottages and garden definitely would have been included. And
why was it not included?
Whenever the scope of what people wanted seemed too much and the lines started to be pulled back, you know, whenever, I mean, people in Soho, Tribeca can tell you, you know, they want X, and then the commission said, well, we can't include this block, we can't include, you know, the lines were pulled back.
The compromise that you spoke of earlier.
Yeah, compromise. And that's why Friends wanted to do, actually it was Helena's effort initially to want to include the that piece of Lexington and some of the side streets off Lexington, which should have been included. Those blocks should have been included. They're wonderful blocks. I mean, with the same kinds of wonderful buildings that any of the other blocks in the historic district have. So anyway, it is no more, the cottages and garden. And I tell you, the architect's name, of course, escapes me for the moment. It may come back. I have a terrible time with names sometimes, and that's why I should have had my notes with me. But he designed the Swiss building on Fifth Avenue. And this building was so beautifully designed, so beautifully constructed. I mean, they were using sledgehammers to knock it down, and they were having difficulty. The bulldozer had a problem. The trees were these magnificent willow trees. I mean, it was so depressing and sad when we actually lost it. But if you're ever interested, I do have photographs somewhere. And it was just magical. I mean, really magical.
Why do you think Landmarks did not designate it?
I have to couch my language here. Influential developer, the plans were underway. The owner, who owned the building that overlooked the cottages and garden, wanted to sell that piece. And while he lived to be 90-something, not Goldman, can't think of his name, but anyway, he always said he would never tear it down. He loved it. He used to sit in a chair in the garden when he was well into his 80s. Just in the end, I guess his family convinced him, whatever, he wanted to sell it. And a deal was struck between Rosen and the owner, and that was that. And the Landmarks Commission, you know, balances these kinds of things.
Right, because in my research I saw that Rosen used that as an argument for why he could develop that piece of land, because it had not been designated.
Definitely. And the ironic thing with Rosen, and I can say this with some authority, because when we were trying to save the cottages and garden, we went to his office, and there was a bulletin board next to the desk we were sitting in front of, and it said, another landmark property. And it was the Seagram building. He owns the Seagram building. He owns the Lever House. You know, he began to collect landmark properties, you know. And here we were trying to landmark this property, and of course it didn't coincide with his, you know, efforts. But it's too bad, because for the neighborhood, you know, there's a whole, on several levels, not just for its worthiness from an historic point of view, because there's no other place, it wasn't any other place like it that I know of. We have some of the little courts and things, you know, Sniffin Court, the one, the Spanish, I can't think of some of the others. But anyway, they'll come to me as well. But, you know, there are other places like the cottages and garden, but this one was unique. I mean, truly unique. So, you know, can't win them all. It was depressing.
I want to talk a little bit about the LPC, since, you know, it seems that, you know, sort of depending on who the commissioner is or what other influences may be affecting their decisions, different outcomes are the case. I was just curious about your observations on the commission over the years, or impressions of the various chairs.
Well, look, this is New York, and we have a lot going for us in terms of how we protect landmarks, historic districts, historic areas. Other cities don't. I mean, they're not quite up to our, I mean, maybe you can compare Boston, maybe, and other cities have caught up, but we have a lot going for us in that respect. But politics rears its ugly head in all of these decisions. And when you look at how the commissioners are appointed, who appoints the different commissioners, the influence of the mayor in different agencies like the Public Design Commission, the Landmarks Commission, real estate, as I said before, is the engine that drives the city. And zoning regulations very often interfere with the decision-making process on the part of the Landmarks Commission because they feel they have to balance, you know, their decisions. I mean, really, you would think of a Landmarks Preservation Commission as being focused on preserving landmarks. And if you're preserving a landmark, whether the zoning says X, Y, or Z, you preserve the landmark. It doesn't always turn out that way. And the relationship of tall buildings to areas like the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side, how they relate to those neighborhoods, the size, the height and bulk of buildings, how tall a commission has, you know, they have some power over how tall buildings. We've said for years there is no as of right in historic districts because it has to go to the Landmarks Commission. But the Landmarks Commission tries to make balanced decisions, and it's part of the whole political structure of a city like New York, and that's how it works. You know, if they go too far one way, the Real Estate Board of New York starts screaming at the top of their lungs. You know, if they go the other way, you know, preservationists are cheering. In fact, there's a series of articles, and now somebody just mailed them to me, Jack Taylor. He's wonderful that way. In the Post, there was an article about Patty Harris, the mayor's deputy mayor, and how this mayor is very pro-preservation and historic districts and like. And then you had a land use attorney, Stephen Meister, writing the next day about how preservation is unhealthy for the city and causes high rents. You know, this is the eternal struggle. But, you know, preservationists want it all. I mean, we do. We want to save almost all of these buildings, you know, I mean, everywhere in New York, and you're bumping up against politics, and that's what it is. And it's very difficult to get past that. So you'll find that there are neighborhood battles all over the city where people are so enraged that their areas are not being preserved, that they're willing to go to the mat for those areas. If it requires hiring an attorney, they raise the money somehow. And these are not wealthy areas. Some years ago, we saved a building called City and Suburban York Avenue Estates. And that is a phenomenal place. There are two model tenements in the Upper East Side. One is City and Suburban First Avenue Estates. One is City and Suburban York Avenue Estates. And the York Avenue Estates are between 79th and 78th, between York and the river. And that building, the complex, was the response to the old law tenements and the terrible conditions in old law tenements. And it was a philanthropic, limited investment effort to create a healthy living condition for poor people, and succeeded admirably. There was a competition, you know, for design. There were light courts, and I mean, the whole thing is just amazing if you visit it. When I was at Friends, we had a tour, which I led. We take people to the Lower East Side Tenement Museum and then bring them to City and Suburban to see the difference. And it was remarkable.
Yeah.
The apartments are very small but charming, and the windows are very large. So you have the feeling that it's not such a small apartment. And the light and air is just remarkable. Right. So that battle, and this was not like, you know, a battle maybe on Madison Avenue, was 10, I think between 10 and 12 years. That's how long it lasted. Board of Estimate divided the complex in half, gave half to Calico, the developer, said the other half could be preserved. He wanted to build a building initially as tall as the Empire State Building. Then he lowered and was going to build four buildings of like 30 or 40 stories. And after many, many years of battling, Ed Kostikian was the attorney. It was resolved in the Court of Appeals and won. One of the few examples of an Article 78 being won. We challenged the decision of the Board of Estimate to do this and prevailed in the Court of Appeals. And it had to be put together again. Now, it hadn't been torn down. He did do some alterations. Sad thing about the First Avenue Estates, if you've been in that area, you can see the pink stucco.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that. At the time, the people in the First Avenue Estates didn't feel the threat, the immediate threat. It was a different developer, Stahl, owner at the time. And they didn't have this imminent threat from a developer. So they were reluctant to join in. So one of the worst mistakes, we should have really pressed them at the time. And we just, you know, we said, okay, that's it. You don't want to join us, you know, because that's what happened. And there's an example of an owner getting an alteration permit before the building had been calendared. So he was able to do what he did. Just disgraceful, disgraceful.
And he's now claiming hardship. Is that correct?
He's attempting to make a hardship case. He went before the Landmarks Commission. That company went before. We testified on that because that was something we were very close to. And if they can't possibly grant hardship. I mean, it's so ludicrous, his argument, honestly, you know, that they can't rent the apartments, you know, $600, I think he was saying, ridiculous nonsense.
Yeah, I was at that hearing.
Yes, yes. And, you know, but you see how the system works, you know, big, heavy-duty land use attorneys and people making the case and, you know, the other side making its case, but... there are no other model tenements like those two. There are other similar places, Harlem River houses, you know, throughout the city, the examples of attempts to provide that kind of solid, healthy housing. But happily, they've been, you know, preserved.
I love the name of your organization, Defenders.
That was Tony's name. He chose that.
Okay.
We thought it was a bit much at the time. It was, okay, Defenders.
So I also a phrase that you used earlier was forewarned is forearmed, which I really like that. And I feel like they really go together well. And maybe you can describe, you know, the sort of the essence of defending something and being more proactive and... You know, is that a role that the organization plays?
Yes, it is. Here's an example in an unrelated kind of... it's actually part of city government. I've been a member of the local community board, as has Elizabeth, for many, many years. When I first joined, almost nobody came and spoke in the public session. Certainly no one from Madison Avenue would think of going to a community board to say, you know, this building is being torn down, we need your help, whatever, you know. Nobody came. You know, a few people said, oh, the traffic light's not working or whatever. People, times have changed with this kind of real estate pressure. These valuable historic resources are under threat one way or another. Very innovative and ingenious ideas on the part of developers sometimes, how they can combine a landmark building with a huge building, you know, all kinds of things coming down the pike. There is a need, and working with communities like that, where you see that they just don't know how to get started, valuable advice is just that, valuable advice at a critical time when you're trying to save something very important, like a historic building or an area, and getting people organized, and that's the hardest thing to do, you know, getting... people focused and organized, because people all have their ideas, you know, about how to go about something. But it's happening now with the Metropolitan Museum. I don't know if you know about that proposal.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it was unanimously approved at the Landmarks Commission. There's a proposal for the 100th anniversary of the Metropolitan Museum. Kevin Roche, who was an incredible architect, designed the grand stair. The original stair of the Metropolitan Museum was a stair that was flanked by two, I think it was limestone, sort of rectangular or stone base things that had lanterns, lighting fixtures, you know, of the period on top, and you'd enter right up the middle. his idea was to open up the stair, have this grand stair, and you could enter from north, south, east. And the two fountains, symmetrical fountains, which used to have plumes of water going up 20 feet, it was amazing. And for a modern architect, he was able to create this classic design, which referred to the Beaux-Arts building, respected it. Some people said it was cold. I think Ada Louise Huxtable at the time said it was a cold design because there was so much exposed stone. So some trees were added. They were never taken care of. The fountains fell into disrepair. And along came, and how this happened, I guess David Koch is a member of the board of Lincoln Center and also a member of the board at the Metropolitan, liked the fountain at Lincoln Center a lot. He wanted a similar fountain or fountains in front of the Met. He said, wouldn't that be nice? And then the whole issue of removing vendors from the steps and removing people from sitting on the steps. The argument was so strange that Lori Olin, landscape design firm, was hired to produce a scheme for the front of the museum. Well, he did indeed, and it's really a re-socialization of that entire space. They would destroy the existing fountains, keep the grand stair, create two square fountains that would flank the staircase, re-landscape both sides of the stair, have a food kiosk, a ticket booth, 400 tables and chairs, parasols. It's a sort of like putting Bryant Park.
I was going to say, it sounds like Bryant Park.
In front of the Metropolitan Museum. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And people are going to interact and everyone's going to be happy forever. Well, I'm sorry. I've been in New York a long time. I hate to say my age.
No.
But there are iconic spots that mean something, not just to us, but to the rest of the world. You know, we did testify at the Public Design Commission. And why do they want people not to sit on the steps? I mean, there are the Spanish steps in Rome. It's like traditional there. I mean, yes, you could re-landscape the area. We were for that. You know, make it greener if that's what you want to do, but have it relate to what is there. There is a park. Has anyone noticed Central Park is right there, you know, surrounding the wonderful Beaux-Arts building? But this was just too much. It's overwhelming. So the wagons are circling now. People are very upset. This group on, you know, the people who live in the area, the Fifth Avenue neighbors, you know, whenever you live near a so-called community facility, that's what they're described as in the zoning resolution. They actually say they're as of right because they're compatible uses, okay? Whether it's a university, a medical institution, a cultural institution, many of these institutions are no longer compatible. They are going beyond what the concept of compatibility is. And it's always this eternal struggle. It's the nature of the beast. You live near a school, a hospital, and something is going to go awry in the future. And that's what's happened once again. They have not been a good neighbor, the Met. And this is sad because that is their asset. That building is their asset. And, you know, it means a lot to visitors as well as it should mean a lot to them. But they think it's wonderful. And everyone else thinks it's terrible, you know. So we're there again. But the Landmarks Commission did, and the Public Design Commission didn't say yay or nay, but they looked at the four or five aspects of this design and made recommendations on each of the aspects. So it's going to come back in a month or so with the institution's response to their suggestions. I think the only commissioner who voted against it was Polshek, James Polshek.
So you were also involved with Historic Districts Council. You were on the board of the HDC.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, for many years.
And so I just want to sort of go a little broader to basically New York organizations, Historic Districts Council, MAS, the Landmarks Conservancy. What role do those citywide organizations play?
Well, the Landmarks Conservancy is in a role, I think it has a very special role because it fulfills a need that I think exists all over the city with religious institutions. It helps churches, synagogues, other religious institutions keep their physical plants going because it's very difficult. You know, things change. Some of our most historic and beautiful buildings are religious institutions, and to keep those in good repair, you know, it requires a little help, and they're very innovative in their suggestions. They have a whole book of a list of various contractors and so on, and they also provide grants to religious institutions. So they're a wonderful both advocacy group and preservation group. MAS has pulled back a bit. I don't know why. There were some financial issues there, whatever happened, but they seem not to be as involved in preservation as they once were. They have a preservation committee, and that committee always reviewed, you know, major issues. They reviewed the children's zoo. They didn't like that at all, and there was a lot of controversy about it. But, you know, other kinds of things. They always had a role, a very important role, I thought. And Historic Districts Council is a citywide group, and we go where other people, I think, in many ways fear to tread, although some of them do go there. We go to the places where there isn't a lot of support, parts of the city where there are little neighborhoods where people have a very conscious idea of what is important historically, but they just don't have the resources to, you know, get the ball rolling, to get the necessary funding or to get organized. Same kind of thing I was talking about before. And HDC does. That's one of our most important roles, going to places in the city most people have never heard of, you know, wonderful places, historic places. Simeon and our staff go out there and explain what needs to be done and listen, you know. And sometimes, sadly, some of the places people want to save don't rise to the level of, you know, importance. And then you have to say, no, we don't think, maybe zoning change would be the way to save this area. And that's true. You know, that's something that is beginning to be discussed more and more, that because this is one of the great accusations from the development community, that it's just a way to stop development, preservation. And I think maybe some people may think of it that way and use it that way, preservation, but it's... A zoning change might achieve the same goal. It's not always landmarking that saves an area. A zoning change can save an area too. And sadly, some of the same development members of the development community are against zoning changes as well. You know, they just want this kind of free market. You build wherever you want to build, whoever owns the property, you keep this, you know, there's a happy medium which we've been unable to reach in the city, you know. I don't know. But so HDC fills a role that I think none of the other groups citywide, and we really, I don't know if you know about our grassroots awards, you know, that's coming up. We have a wonderful fellow by the name of Ted Grunewald. I had never met him before until the Manufacturers Hanover Trust building was under threat. And he was this one-man band, you know, he led the charge, and he came out of nowhere, you know, to say, this is important. He was part of Doko Momo, the group Doko Momo, and trying to get, and he was so successful in raising consciousness and getting people's attention. Eric got involved in this whole battle. And he's just a remarkable fellow. And so he's getting a grassroots award. But,
Zoning as a tool seems recent, or at least has been being used maybe more recently. So I guess the question is, you formed the group in 2002, and then here we are 10 years later, and what changes have you seen take place, and have we made progress, and sort of have there been turning points that you can identify?
Yeah. I'm chairman of the Zoning and Development Committee at the Community Board, have been for a number of years. We have an application before the Department of City Planning, and it's taking a very long time to get through the system, but hopefully this year something will happen. But many years ago, in the 80s, there was, when the Upper East Side Historic District was going through and the mid-block zoning was being changed, the hospitals, Far East, we have several major institutions, wanted to exempt a couple of properties because they were under construction doing work. And the mid-block throughout the Upper East Side were to be zoned RAB, which is contextual zoning, which allowed buildings up to a height of 60 feet with a setback 75 feet for all owners of property, and they were given 4.0 FAR. There was an exception for community facilities. They were given a little more, 5.1 FAR, in the mid-blocks to allow these buildings to be completed. It was supposed to be temporary. And everyone assumed it would just sort of, there would be a sunset provision somehow, and it would just go off into the sunset and never be heard from again. And then everyone, all owners of property in mid-blocks anywhere, would have 4.0. It didn't happen. It remained 5.1 for community facilities. And that flies in the face of what the historic district means, you know, keeping the low-scale brownstone character. It's almost a constitutional issue in the sense that owners of identical property have different rights. You know, I mean, the community facility is next door. I'm here. I get 4.0. They get 5.1. You know, people, question that. So some years ago, it was actually the Department of City Planning that recommended we address this. We said, what issues? This is before I was chair of the committee. So we sort of inherited this. Anyway, we've applied to return all of the community facility designated properties to 4.0, to have it all be the same. We're the only community board in the whole city that has this, because it was specific to these institutions at the time. And that's one change we hope goes through. Madison Avenue was rezoned. Elizabeth probably spoke about this. She was very instrumental and spearheaded this change, where the Madison Avenue zoning regulations, you could build huge buildings, you know, 30, 40 stories on Madison. In fact, if you go up to the 90s, you'll see a couple of them. And there was so much controversy about the result of these buildings being built that they rezoned Madison Avenue so that it is 19 stories or 210 feet now. The issue of developers buying buildings like the Citibank building, like 980 Madison, and applying for these zoning text amendments to exempt that specific site from the regulations, you know, they don't have to set back at a certain height, whatever they want, is not a good policy. And we're addressing that now. It's how to preserve the context and character of historic districts. I think that's, we're here talking about preservation. But zoning plays a very important part in the city. In the 70s, there were a lot of master plans being developed by the Department of City Planning. Where are they today? I know there are a couple of them come up in the last 10 years, but it's not like those days. We need to think about the city as a whole and what different neighborhoods mean, you know, what their value is. In fact, the Landmarks Law incorporates real property value into, they have to consider real property value. You know, what does that mean to us? Is there should be a value between, and I know there, in my heart there is, between, and once you develop an historic district, you think of places like Soho and Tribeca, fought by the Real Estate Board of New York. They all want to be there. They all want to be there. Why? There's a value there. And there's a value in the Upper East Side. And to defend his last building, Rosen was saying, we are a tired neighborhood, we're over the hill, we need more exciting buildings. People move there because it's, you want to describe it as over the hill? Fine, that's your definition. It's not over the hill, it's a wonderful residential neighborhood, you know, and with beautiful buildings. So, you know, that's why we're here.
Right. I mean, people move to Park Slope out of Manhattan all the time, and
exactly.
Park Slope's a neighborhood that, you know, 30 years ago was,
yeah.
You know, no one would think that would be a place to.
It's amazing. We have tours at Defenders, and we went out to Park Slope and had a wonderful tour, and we were amazed at the buildings and the restaurants, and, you know, it just become this incredible place. Just amazed. So, anyway.
So, I'm going to start to wrap up, and I just have one last question mm-hmm. for you, and it's sort of open-ended, and it's to someone that you meet that may be new to preservation or new to the idea of saving place, or just beginning to work in preservation now, what would be sort of your message to them What should they know and what should they be thinking about?
Well, I would say be passionate, because passion takes you a long way. You do things you would never do. I mean, it's like an insane person when you're overly passionate. You're pushed forward by this strong feeling that you're right about something. You have a gut feeling about something, and you're passionate. And when you see a beautiful building, a wonderful building, whatever it is, or an area, be passionate. And when the passion will get you into offices, into talk to elected officials, it'll get you very far. You have to go beyond that passion, you know, organize. But I think having passion about something is very, very important. I also would urge young people to get involved in preservation, because we often say, who's bringing up the rear here? We're these old people now, you know, and we won't be here much longer. But honestly, the young people getting more and more involved in preservation, and there have been people who have had wonderful battles, you know, who are certainly younger than I am, you know, who are involved in preservation, but we need more young people in preservation. But the passion is very important, the organizational skills, not giving up. If we were in the city and suburban battle, and I'm not going to mention names, but very important people were advising us to compromise. Not just advising us, pressuring us to compromise. And we would meet. People were crying. They would be sitting around a table like this, crying. We didn't want to give up. We didn't want to give up. And we could not see that building divided in half. And we ignored them. And we prevailed. And it was the passion and belief that we were right to save these important buildings. And that's what I would say. You know, the passion is what you first experience when you see something, you know, so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that will resonate with a lot of people.
Yeah, and young people. Young people are naturally passionate about stuff, you know, and so they're natural. You know, we have to find them, recruit them, get them involved.
All right, well, that's why I'm here today. So,
well
Terry, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.